loud heartbeats. I dug my nails into my palms, striving for calm, trying to think, who could have done this? Kunti? But she only knew of the granary, not of this other hiding place. My own family? No. I thought with despair, thrusting aside the small core of suspicion each time it formed. Surely not. Who else? Who? A long time passed, when at last I rose. My limbs were stiff and prickling, and darkness had given way to the first gray beginnings of dawn. Nathan was not in the hut when I went back. I saw him sitting beside the paddy fields, as he often did when he could not sleep. The boys were still asleep, the two older ones side by side. Kuti squeezed close to Ira, and she with her arm thrown across him. I shook her by the shoulder, and Kuti woke first and began to cry. I picked him up and took him outside and left him there. And when I went back, the others were awake. I looked at the three faces and I thought bitterly, one of them has done this to me. Which one? Which one? I thought, questioning, looking at the three faces as if to read their thoughts. But there was nothing to see save alarm. They shrank a little from my vehemence. I must know, I shouted. I must know who has done this thing. They looked at me as if I had lost my senses. Ira said timidly, we would not take what belongs to us all. Tell me I am imagining the loss, I stormed at her, or that I myself have eaten it. They stared at me in silence, amazed. Outside, Kuti was bawling. Attracted by his cries, Nathan had come up. Now he called to me. See the child, he said, frowning. Can you not hear him? He will choke. So much the better, I said. It will be one less mouth to feed. You are ill, he said. You do not know what you are saying. He picked up the child, soothing him in his arms, and then gave him to Ira. My heart is sick, I said. I have been robbed, and by one of my own children, of rice, which of all things is the most precious. Is that what you have said to them? I nodded. I saw his face wither. I took it, he said at last. You? My husband? I do not believe it. It is true. Silence fell like a shroud. I listened to it, locked in my own brooding bitterness. Then it was rent by a sound so raw, so painful, that my nerves began screaming in response. I looked up, and it was Nathan. His face was working. From his throat came these dry, hideous sobs. Not for myself, he was muttering, trying to control his treacherous voice. For another. I took it for another. There was no other way. I hoped you would not notice. I had to do it. I went to him. I did not want to know any more why he had done it or for whom. It was no longer important. But he was still speaking. It was as if he could not stop. Kunti took it all. I swear, she forced me. I did not want you to know. Presently, he was quiet. She has a strange power, this woman, I said half to myself. Not strange, Nathan said. I am the father of her sons. She would have told you, and I was weak. Disbelief first. Disillusionment, anger, reproach, pain, to find out after so many years in such a cruel way. Callie's words, she has fire in her body, men burn before and after. My husband was one of those men. He had known her not once but twice. He had gone back to give her a second son. And between how many times, I thought bleak of spirit, while her husband in his impotence and I in my innocence did nothing. It was a long time ago, Nathan said. I was very young, and she is a skillful woman. The first time was before our marriage, he said. One did not see the evil for the beauty, he said. At last I made an effort and roused myself. It is as you say, a long time ago, I said wearily. That she is evil and powerful, I know myself. Let it rest. It became possible for me to speak as well. I told him of her earlier visit and the grain she had extorted from me also, and it seemed to me that a new peace came to us then, freed at last from the necessity for lies and concealment and deceit, with the fear of betrayal lifted from us, and with the power we ourselves had given her wrested finally from Kunti. Now that the last rice was gone, it was in a sense a relief. No amount of scheming and parring would make it go any further. The last grain had been eaten. Thereafter we fed on whatever we could find. The soft ripe fruit of the prickly pear, a sweet potato or two, blackened and half rotten, thrown away by some prosperous hand. sometimes a crab that Nathan managed to catch near the river. Early and late, my sons roamed the countryside, returning with a few bamboo shoots, a stick of sugarcane left in some deserted field, or a piece of coconut picked from the gutter in the town. For these, they must have ranged widely. For other farmers and their families, in like plight to ourselves, were also out searching for food. And for every edible plant or root, there was a struggle, a desperate competition that made enemies of friends and put an end to humanity. It was not enough. Sometimes from sheer rebellion we ate grass, although it always resulted in stomach cramps and violent retching. For hunger is a curious thing. At first it is with you all the time, waking and sleeping and in your dreams, and your belly cries out insistently. And there is a gnawing and a pain as if your very vitals were being devoured, and you must stop it at any cost, and you buy a moment's respite even while you know and fear the sequel. Then the pain is no longer sharp, but dull, and this too is with you always, so that you think of food many times a day, and each time a terrible sickness assails you, and because you know this, you try to avoid the thought, but you cannot. It is with you. Then that too is gone. All pain, all desire, only a great emptiness is left, like the sky, like a well in drought. And it is now that the strength drains from your limbs, and you try to rise and find you cannot, or to swallow water and your throat is powerless. And both the swallow and the effort of retaining the liquid tax you to the uttermost. It will not be long before the harvest, Nathan would murmur, and I would agree with him, stifling the query whether our strength would last until then, saying, ah yes, not long now, only a little time before the grain is ripe. It happened to me too, but I could not see myself, only what happened to others, saw their flesh melt away and their skin sag and sink between their jutting bones, saw their eyes retreat into their skulls, saw their ribs curve out from under the skin, and what withered the young bore doubly hard on the old, and they were emaciated twice over. But of us, Kuti suffered the most. He had never been a healthy child. Now he was constantly ailing. At first he asked for rice water and cried because there was none, but later he gave up asking and merely just cried. Even in his sleep, he whimpered, twisting and turning endlessly, permitting to no one to rest. Ira was the gentlest with him, and tirelessly patient, nursing him in her skinny arms and giving him most of what he came to her. But more often than not, he turned away, unable to take the rough food we offered, and then she would hold him against her and give him her breast, and he would pull at the parched teat and be soothed, and for a while his thin wailing would die away. Chapter 15. One day, Raha went out as usual and did not come back. At dusk, they brought his body home, slung between two men, one at the head and one at the feet. There was a small trickle of blood running from his mouth, fresh and still bright red, and more blood from a cut in his head, dark and congealed, here and matting his hair. They laid him on the ground. They bowed their heads and shuffled their feet and spoke in low voices, and then they went away. It was real, yet it seemed a nightmare. It could not be true that my son lay dead before me. Thus my thoughts, dazed and confused, injected pain where there was numbness, and my mind, furtively touching the edges of realization, then fleeing from it in terror. He had been caught, they said. Something about money. What had my son to do with money? Who had not a pie of his own? He was not very strong, they told me. They merely laid hands on him and he fell. As if I did not know how thin and brittle he had grown. But why should others lay hands on him? They told me, but the sense of their words escaped. They told me, but I could not remember. They repeated themselves again and again, but I kept forgetting. I heard Ira begin to sing a low dirge. She was rocking gently back and forth, and she was crying. What are you crying for? I said. You have little enough strength without dissolving it in tears. She looked at me stupidly in a way, and down at her brother. Her sorrow flowed to me. The numbness began to clear. I tried frantically to keep it. I might as well have tried to imprison a cloud. For this I have given you birth, my son. that you should lie in the end at my feet with ashes in your face and coldness in your limbs, and yourself departed without a trace, leaving his huddle of bones and flesh without meaning. Already, I think, the eyes must be closed. Though death has glazed them, and I do so, the jaw must be tied, for it is sagging. I put a bandage about it. The body must be washed, and I wash it. An ear comes to help and cleanses the mouth, which I have forgotten to do. These things were you. Now there is no connection whatever. The sorrow within me is not for this body which has suffered and in suffering has let slip the spirit, but for you, my son. Nathan prepares the bier. I see him lifting the body onto it. Then he goes out, walking towards the town. At dawn, the funeral drums begin, and soon after our friends and neighbors come. Granny first, though hardly able to walk. Then Durgan, Kanan and his wife, bearing a few jasmine buds. And Callie, bringing with her a muslin cloth to cover the bier. They pay their respects in silence, and when the sun has risen, the men pick up the bier and depart. But the women stay behind, for this is the custom. All that morning, the sound of the drums comes faintly to us, rising and falling with the wind, until at last a final beat comes quivering through the air, and we strain our ears for the next. But this sound which has already gone, is the last. Now not even a heap of bones, only a few ashes to show that once a man has lived. Raha had not been dead 3 full days when 2 officials from the tannery came to see us, and the one who was tall and burly with long mustaches did all the talking, and the other who was thin and insignificant stepped timidly in his shadow and agreed with what he said. The watchmen were only doing their duty, the tall one began. They are engaged to protect our property, you understand. I understand. No violence was used, he said, only enough to stop him. You agree it was necessary? He was doing nothing. On the contrary, he was seen in the yard, where he had no business to be, and when the Chowkitters caught him, they found he had stolen a calfskin. I do not believe it, I said. What use had he for such a thing? Not in itself, maybe, he replied in a strained voice, as if struggling to keep his temper. But of course he could have sold it anywhere. We have had a lot of losses recently. You cannot blame my son, I said wearily. We live from hand to mouth, as you can see. There is no wealth here, such as your goods might have brought. I am not blaming your son alone, he said carefully. But of course it is well known your sons have been troublemakers. Now we do not want any trouble from you, you understand? The lad was caught in the act of stealing, maybe, as you say, for the first time and in a moment of weakness. Still, he was caught, and for the consequences that followed, no one was to blame except himself. He should not have struggled. In these circumstances, you naturally have no claim on us. Claim? I said. I have made no claim. I do not understand you. He made a gesture of impatience. You may think of it later and try to get compensation. I warn you, it will not work. Compensation, I thought. What compensation is there for death? I felt confused. I did not understand what he was getting at. There was a pause. The timid man said kindly, he was not brutally treated or anything, you know. They merely tapped him with a lathi as he was trying to escape and he fell. He must have been very weak or something. He was, I said. He worked hard and ate little. Naturally, it must have been a blow for you, said the timid one. It is hard to lose. That is, he trailed off incoherently, seeing his companion's glance fixed on him. The point is, the other said, and he thumped the floor to emphasize the point, that no fault attaches to us. Absolutely none. Of course, as my friend has said, it is your loss. But not remember our responsibility. Perhaps, he went on, you may even be the better off. You have many mouths to feed, and... The thinner man raised his hand to check him, appalled by the words, yet scared by his own daring. Poor little mouse, that gesture must have taken all his courage. He had none left for speech. His aggressive companion stopped short. The look of surprise spreading over his face was quickly replaced by displeasure. He turned to me. I did not intend to wound you, but sometimes the truth must be stated, unpalatable as it is. I nodded. There was no sense in agreeing or disagreeing. The gulf between us was too wide. It was no use at all flinging our words at each other across that gasping chasm. So you agree, he insisted. No responsibility attaches to us. Yes, I said. My lips felt stiff. I am glad everything is settled then. An unpleasant matter, but amicably settled. He drew his lips back, imitating a smile, and turned triumphantly to his companion. Did I not tell you there would be no trouble? You always fear the worst. I told you they would be reasonable. The other did not look triumphant. If anything, he seemed to have shrunk a little. He avoided looking at me altogether, but as they went out together, he glanced at me quickly, once, and in that brief moment I saw that his eyes were grieving. You should not care, I said softly to him alone. It does not matter. He heard me and half turned, his eyes clearing a little. I am very sorry for you, he said in a low voice. May you find your peace. He went, his face overlaid with shame and misery. Chapter 16. There is the reaping, I said, and the threshing and winnowing. How shall we manage when the time comes? When the time comes, Nathan said with a gleam in his eye, the strength will be forthcoming. Never fear. I looked at him doubtfully, thin and drawn, with thighs and arms so puny that no muscle showed even when he flexed them. The rice would have to be lifted plant by plant, and the grain separated from the husk, and the husk beaten for the last few grains. It meant working long hours in the flooded fields with bent back, and much laboring thereafter converting the paddy into rice. It was no task for weakened bodies. You will see, he said with confidence, we will find our strength. One look at the swelling grain will be enough to renew our vigor. Indeed, it did our hearts good to see the paddy ripen. We watched it as a dog watches a bone, jealousy, lest it be snatched away, or as a mother her child, with pride and affection, and most of all with fear. As we sat there, Irrawaddy came to us, stepping softly. It is hot within, she said forlornly. I could not rest. She went and picked a head of paddy before sitting down beside us. I saw her fingers parting the husk, feeling for the grain within. How much longer? The same question, the answer to which she already knew, who had lived on the same land since birth. 3 weeks, Nathan's reply, grave, sincere, absolutely honest, where another might have been tempted to easier words. It is not long to wait, I said, trying to hearten her, and if the gods are kind, it may even be sooner. That was what we prayed for, that it might not be too late. The tears that brightened Ira's eyes, the silences of my husband, the twitching face of Selvam, all came from one thing, the thought, imprisoned in the brain but incapable of utterance, that Kuti might not live to see the harvesting. The rest of us might struggle on. Our endurance was greater. But he was only a child, not yet 5, who had already waited a long time and who had suffered more than any of us, whether from the unsuitable food or from the constant restless movement of his body. He had developed a thick, irritating rash, which he kept scratching, and where his nails caught, sores and blisters began, destroying whatever little peace he might have had. Sometimes, after moaning for hours at a stretch, he would fall into an exhausted daze. It could not be called sleep. It was nothing so sweet. And I would go to him with beating heart to see if the fight was ended. But again and again, he struggled back to consciousness, took up again his tormented living. Almost I wished it otherwise. Some 2 or 3 days later, I noticed a change in Kuti. His eyes lost their dullness, and the whimpering had been so harrowing to listen, to lessen and stop. I thought it was the end, a brief rallying, a frothing up of the last reserves of strength, when there is no longer any need to hold back, like the sudden brilliant glow of an expiring taper. Since we gave him nothing, there had been nothing to give that might count for the change. The following day, however, the improvement continued, and that night he slept peacefully. I gazed at the small, tired face, soothed by sleep as it had not been for many nights. And even as I puzzled about the change, profound